On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Oliver Rist in the Twilight House today. Now, there is an elephant in the room, and it's definitely cybersecurity. Now, the question is, do organizations spend money on digital transformations and optimize their business workflows, or do they spend the dough on cybersecurity? We'll definitely talk about it. Plus, we have a great guest, Andy Bain. He's CEO of Element. And he's going to take us through some of the challenges organizations face with data and how just how your organization might be able to take that unstructured, unorganized data from operations, make it easy to trust, manage, and analyze. You definitely shouldn't miss it. Twyatt on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 470, recorded November 19th, 2021. Skata patata. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Bandwidth. Bandwidth understands the challenges enterprises face when migrating their communications to the cloud. That's why Bandwidth launched Duet for Microsoft Teams, the only complete solution for direct routing and Microsoft certified E911 available direct from a carrier designed to simplify your migration to Teams direct routing. Request your proof of concept at bandwidth.com/twit. And by Thinkst Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box. And by Melissa. The U.S. Postal Service processes more than 98,000 address changes daily. Is your customer contact data up to date? Try Melissa's APIs in the developer portal. It's easy to log on, sign up, and start playing in the API sandbox 24/7. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in a professional, an expert in their field. Today we have a longtime friend of the show and one of our newest co-hosts. He's the executive editor of business at PC Mag, and he's Mr. Oliver Rist. Oliver, so great to have you on the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Lou. Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Now, I'm an avid follower of your beat. I can definitely tell you that. In fact, I've just recently read your identity management solution article recently. But can you maybe tell the audience at home, give them a little taste of the things that you cover?
Well, PC Mag, on the business side, we like to cover cloud services. I don't get to do servers anymore or routers or any of that sexy stuff that I like. I got to do cloud services. So anything from those identity management systems that just came out all the way up to CRM systems or HR management systems, whatever you can get that's deployed in the cloud and can take a, you know, basically a user per month charge. That's
right.
Our stuff.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, I like a cloud service or two for sure. Well, the rest of the Twyatt crew will be back on the next show and most likely tell us about all of their adventures that they have behind the scenes. I'm definitely looking forward to that. But I'm also looking forward to today's show as well, because Oliver and I are going to go through some pretty interesting topics. In fact, let's talk about the elephant in the room. It's definitely cybersecurity. The question is, do organizations spend enough money on that, or are they focusing on digital transformation to help optimize some of their other business workflows? So we'll definitely talk about that. Plus, we have a great guest, Andy Bain. He's CEO of Element, and he's going to take us through some of the challenges organizations have with data and just how your organization might be able to take that unorganized, inconsistent data from operations and make it easy to trust, manage, and analyze. So stick around. Lots to talk about there. But before we do and we get all those exciting topics, let's go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. Now, the chip market has been hit hard by the supply chain issues during the pandemic. Now, we've heard about car manufacturers not being able to deliver new vehicles and features because of it. Now, Apple's iPhone production has even been impacted here as well as other portions of the industry. Now, the question is, as supply chain starts to solve their challenges and heal their pipeline, Will there be things that get better first? Where will things get better first? Now, there's an even harder question to ask. What if the Chinese government decided to first fulfill their needs rather than the rest of the world? Well, apparently, that might be the case. A new report from Bloomberg says that the Chinese government has created a new committee that maintains a white list of China-based companies that are building hardware software so it can replace foreign technology in sensitive sectors. Huahong Semiconductor, the second largest contract chip maker in China, has notified its foreign customers that it now has to prioritize Chinese clients. That means it will no longer be able to provide them a similar allocation of chips to what they've had in the past. And the company even has to cancel some orders due to a new national policy. That policy spreads well beyond chips as well. Now, as an analog to this, we're seeing this type of anti-competitive behavior in the recent lawsuits against Google, where they're favoring their results and ads over other companies. Now, Huahong recently notified Holtec, a Taiwan-based microcontroller supplier, that it may not be able to offer its production capacity in 2022 than it had in 2021 because of that they had to prioritize customers from mainland China. Now, the foundry warned them that it might have to drop some orders from foreign clients, citing China's national policy to prioritize demand for homegrown chip designers and supply constraints. Now, China reportedly implemented the policy to improve local supply chain resilience. Now, the contractor chip makers Huahong and SMIC produced the majority of their ICs using mature process technologies. That means if the rest of the world wanted to start fixing this problem on their side, they would need years to catch up. Now, another question is that enough case for them to not try and catch up? Well, we've heard of Intel taking the next steps here to create a foundry and additional facilities in the U.S. to cover some of that gap. One hopes that the rest of the device manufacturers look to chip makers to bring manufacturing away from suppliers who can't actually supply them.
Looks like NVIDIA's ARM acquisition is heading for the dumpster. So NVIDIA confirmed that the U.S. Federal Trade Commission is now scrutinizing its proposed merger with the U.K. chip design provider ARM. So both the U.S. FTC and the U.K.'s Competition and Markets Authority are conducting investigations now into whether that merger would not only be legal, but would also make that the chip shortage that we're all suffering that much worse. So because that includes not just PC and smartphone people, that also includes IoT device makers, self-driving cars, robotics, gaming, all kinds of things. The main issue is that ARM's chipset designs get licensed to a long list of companies, many of which are now also NVIDIA customers. So that's Apple, Qualcomm, Samsung, a whole lot more. So now if NVIDIA controls ARM, then they also have a much tighter control over what those customers can buy and how they can compete. And that means they'll have control across multiple markets. And aside from the U.S. and the U.K., the deal is also being questioned by the EU and China. So all four are concerned with competitive problems and that worsening chip shortage and how high that might drive chip prices. So frankly, I'm not sure why NVIDIA is pushing this right now. It might look really sweet now, but if it goes through, they're going to have a lot more legal hassles, I think, than they're bargaining for in the future.
Now, we've heard about the recent arrests regarding affiliates of Revel ransomware group. It was supposed to actually stop the nefarious activity from the group that was creating havoc for the industry. However, that doesn't mean a new ransomware group will not organically develop either. In late October, Sophos Rapid Response Team encountered a new ransomware group with an interesting approach to holding victims' files hostage. Now, the ransomware used by this group, who identify themselves as the Memento Team, doesn't encrypt files, actually. Instead, it actually copies files into password-protected archives using renamed freeware version of the legitimate file utility WinRAR, and then encrypts that password and deletes the original files. Now, this is a retooling by the ransomware actors who initially attempted to increase files directly but were stopped by endpoint protection. Now, after failing on the first attempt, they changed tactics and redeployed as evidenced by the multiple versions of the ransomware payload compiled at different times found on the victim's network. They then demanded $1 million US to restore the files and threatened data exposure if the victim did not comply. Now, there were some other twists to the Memento attack as well. And the ransomware itself is actually Python 3.9 script compile with Py installer. And in the ransomware note, that largely cribs the format used by Revel, the criminals behind the ransomware instructed the victims to contact them via a Telegram account. Now, the attackers also deployed an open source Python-based keylogger on several machines as they moved literally or laterally within the network using remote desktop protocol. Now, the ransomware attackers appear to have taken advantage of a flaw on VMware's vCenter server web client first revealed in February. And then on May 18th, another entirely different actor also exploited the vCenter vulnerability to install the XMR cryptocurrency miner via PowerShell commands. Then on September 8th, yet another intruder dropped another miner. Now in October, Memento Game began preparations to launch ransomware. Now they dropped a copy of an administrator tool process hacker onto the server they used as a primary foothold on October 1st and configured process hacker's kernel driver as a service for persistence. Now all this comes full circle to a bunch of learnings. And one of those learnings we can't stress enough, especially on the show, and that's to make sure you're patching your servers.
Is iPhone Wi-Fi 6E adoption going to stall because of the chip shortage? So Apple has hinted that it may introduce Wi-Fi 6E on its iPhone 14 next year. So the question is, are there enough Wi-Fi 6E chipsets to do that? The iPhone 13 now has Wi-Fi 6, but the iPhone 14 and that rumored head-mounted display that they want to offer next year are both going to need Wi-Fi 6E chips. Now, that demand is made worse because there are already big-name phones that are using up the current supply of Wi-Fi 6E chips, and that's Google with the Pixel 6 and the Pixel 6 Pro, and also Samsung with its Galaxy S21 Ultra. In the case of Samsung, that's almost certainly going to expand to several of its other mobile devices, which, again, just makes the shortage more pronounced. With all kinds of hybrid work now happening across way more than just a standard desktop or a notebook, Wi-Fi 6E is not only something for your power users, it's very important to IT departments, especially those who are supporting mobile phone fleets. It's got a fatter overall pipe. It's got lower latency. But that's because it supports 2 to 3 times the number of channels as Wi-Fi 6, which is great for performance. But since each channel needs between 2 and 4 chips, you could see Wi-Fi 6E chip usage up to 20 times that of a typical Wi-Fi 6 device. That's a lot of extra chips across a much larger customer range if Apple jumps in. And aside from mobile, that same chip shortage is going to hit home routers and happy days, business-grade Wi-Fi 6 routers and APs too. So since there's little chance of Apple backing off what it wants to do and every chance that its competitors are also going to want to up their Wi-Fi 6E offerings in 2022, you can get set for longer wait times and higher prices on any Wi-Fi 6E purchase you might be looking at next year.
Looking forward to that. Well, spy cameras seem to be trending around the world, especially in specific governments in the world. Now, the question is, would it make you more comfortable to know where the cameras are at or that they're even there? Well, an academic cybersecurity researcher from Singapore and South Korea have repurposed the time of flight sensors in smartphone cameras to help spot concealed spy cameras. Now, ToF sensors help resolve distance between the camera and the subject and have started showing up in smartphones recently. For instance, Apple's iPhone 12, 13, and Samsung Galaxy S20 Plus, among several others, also include a laser-based Sony ToF sensor that's used for augmented reality applications and for adding depth information to 2D imagery. Now, the researchers described a novel strategy to use these sensors to spot hidden spy cams in hotel rooms and washrooms. Jeez. Now, the researchers note that the current generation of the devices that are designed to find these minuscule spy cameras have low detection rates. Proposals to detect the spy cameras using their wireless traffic could help detect their presence, but won't help pinpoint their location. Now, in their paper presented at the ACM conference this year on embedded network sensor systems earlier, now the researchers described their solution dubbed laser-assisted photography detection, which overcomes the limitations of traditional approaches of using ToF sensors on commodity smartphones. If successful, there could be a number of applications for this technology. One hopes it provides a bit of insights into who's watching and why. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we do have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Bandwidth. Provide accurate 911 caller information for Microsoft Team users and maintain compliance with complicated E911 regulations during your migration with Bandwidth Duet for Teams. Now, Bandwidth Duet for Microsoft Teams empowers you to simplify your move to Teams with software-driven SIP, dynamic E911 capabilities, and industry-leading expertise. Solve an E911 challenge for modern enterprises under the federal regulation named RABOMS Act. Enterprises are required to provide a dispatchable location, which includes the street address as well as more granular information, such as building, floor, or room number. Now, the problem is that employees with soft phones often moving freely between campuses, buildings, and remote offices to work and collaborate. So providing accurate location to public safety is actually very challenging. Now, enter Duet for Microsoft Teams, where Bandwidth actually leverages its advanced dynamic E911 for Teams solution to identify the location of a Teams connected user at the time of an emergency call. Now, Bandwidth natively routes the 911 call across their secure, highly reliable nationwide network and provides the caller's current location to help mitigate compliance concerns and also, most importantly, help enhance employee safety. Simplify direct routing migrations. If your organization is considering direct routing, Bandwidth's Duet for Microsoft Teams gives you greater control and value for helping you decouple your telephony from your Teams. You get the advantages of working directly with a cloud-native carrier, including failover control, call forwarding, and real-time reroutes, all on the Microsoft Teams platform. Now, with Bandwidth's Duet for Teams, you save 40% compared to Microsoft calling plans. Rely on unlimited 933 testing capabilities so you can easily verify that your location information meets compliance standards without burdening public safety with live 911 calls. Now, you'll have a migration partner, not just a provider, and you'll get a dedicated onboarding specialist to help execute your project plan, a 24/7 knock, and an expert support team who will accelerate your migration and be with you every step of the way. Now, group your users into logical cohorts like location or department. This way, you can schedule and trigger ports for these individual groups, but also seamlessly roll back if you ever need to. Now, everyone says they've got great support, but Bandwidth proves it by just being easier to work with. Now, Zoom, Genesys, RingCentral all use Bandwidth. Bandwidth's white glove customer support touts a 9.8 customer satisfaction rating, and it's uniquely positioned to help your enterprise migrate with much less friction and meet regulatory expectations. More than just a team shop, no problem. Bandwidth can help simplify your telecom migration to the cloud with a bring your own carrier solution for RingCentral 2 in addition to Microsoft Teams. Check out Bandwidth's Duet for Teams and Duet for RingCentral to see how you can orchestrate your move to the cloud with flexibility and control. Request your proof of concept at bandwidth.com/twit. That's bandwidth.com/twit. And we thank Bandwidth for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, it's fairly common to hear that a business favors processes that may actually increase their revenue stream. Since common sense there. However, with trending topics of cybersecurity and the increased focus on this from regulators, you would think that this would spark more focus on it. Well, according to Trend Micro, their new research revealed that 90% of IT decision makers claim their business would be willing to compromise on cybersecurity in favor of digital transformation, productivity, or other goals. Now, additionally, 82% have felt pressured to downplay the severity of cyber risks to their board. Downplay it. All right, that kind of sparks a twitching nerve in me already, but let's keep going. Now, data shows that IT leaders are self-censoring in front of their boards for fear of appearing repetitive or too negative, with almost a third claiming this is constant pressure. But this will only perpetuate a vicious cycle where C-suite remains ignorant of its true risk exposure. Now, the research reveals that just 50% of IT leaders and 38% of business decision makers believe that C-suite completely understands cyber risk. Now, although some think that this is because the topic is complex and constantly changing, many believe that C-suite either doesn't try hard enough, 26%, or doesn't want to understand, 20%. Now, there's also disagreement between IT and business leaders who over who's ultimately responsible for managing and mitigating the risk. Now, IT leaders are nearly twice as likely as business leaders to point to IT teams and the CISO, and 49% of respondents claim that cyber risks are still being treated as IT problems rather than business risk. Now, the friction of causing potentially serious issues here, 52% of respondents agree that there's organizations' attitude to cyber risk is inconsistent and varies from month to month, up and down. It's a sawtooth here. Now, you know, this is a very interesting set of topics. And obviously, again, they're causing a little bit of twitching. I'm sure maybe it's causing twitching on Oliver's side too. Oliver, I want to throw it to you because you cover a ton of organizations here. Do you find a lot of them are actually making these compromises because they're favoring other business processes?
Look, I'm from New York, so I'm perhaps a shade more cynical than the people at Trend Micro. But I wouldn't say that 90% are thinking about compromising. I think 90% are on a regular basis compromising, right? It's that bad. Typical C-suite guys, their approach to this, and you have to be fair to them, they're dealing with a lot of stuff. They're tossing a lot of money into the IT department and the IT security department, and they're saying, fix this, right? Or keep my stuff safe. They don't want to hear about it until they might get sued. And at that point, yeah, if you're the, you know, you're the chief security officer or whatever, you do want to lie because you're going to get fired. It's a very negative, it's a not proactive and not supportive system, right? It's just finger pointing. Nobody wants to have the finger pointed at them, but also nobody wants to have a lawsuit. So yeah, this is, I'm sure that definitely, in fact, I've interviewed some folks, I can't mention names, but they're case studies who complain about this exact thing, right? They're too scared to even warn them of a potential problem, and yet they don't have the resources to fix it. So they're just trying to band-aid it as much as they can and hope nothing goes wrong.
It's interesting that you say that. Now, I've seen actually some organizations, and again, I can't name names, but I've seen some organizations actually hire red and blue teams. You know, you take a little bit of chunk out of their revenue to go and hire some red and blue teams to actually show the impact of a cybersecurity threat and then bring that data to the C-suite. Have you seen some of that in the wild as well?
Look, PC Mag, we don't interview the really big enterprise type clients. We, you know, our bigger people are more medium sized. But hell, I mean, the company I work for, Ziff Davis, is a typical medium sized company. We're talking, what, 4,000 or 5,000 people, global offices, three big divisions with multiple companies underneath. So there's a lot of touch points. There's a lot of security issues. And we are always looking for improvements to security. If I would have to guess, I'm sure there are weak points in our company, and you know, our IT department is undoubtedly stressed, and there's a big ass, you know, skills gap between general IT and security. So
right,
that's an ongoing problem, and no, I don't know how anyone's going to solve it.
Well, actually, that was my next question to you. I was going to say, maybe put your crystal ball on for a second and say, hey, well, how would we convince the C-suite that they need to spend some more money here? What can organizations potentially do here?
Here's an interesting one. I mean, you tell me, like, I just, a month ago interviewed the chairman of the FIDO Alliance. And he gave me a long rundown on authentication problems and how what you have currently is just not working, whereas FIDO would help for XYZ reasons. And I said, well, you know, best of luck getting that deployed. And he said, well, we already deployed it. It's in a whole bunch of products, including, I believe, Windows Server. And he goes, it's not that it's not there. It's nobody wants to use it. So how do you get a business to adopt something that will cost it money? Just the act of adopting it, right? If it's already there, all they really need to do is find somebody skilled enough to set it up and then suffer through the hiccups and the problems of rolling it out. If that's too much for most businesses, then I don't know, you got me. I don't really know how that would move forward.
Right, right. Well, I think actually some of the respondents here of this research actually totally agree with you. In fact, 62% think that it would actually take a breach of their organization to actually make them move the needle here on providing cybersecurity help or assistance or funding. Now, 62% said it would help if they could better report on and more easily explain the business risk of cyber threats. So that goes back to actually maybe having some data around it and see what it would impact in the business. And 61% actually say it would make an impact if customers start demanding more sophisticated cybersecurity credentials. So that means that you'd have to leak your dirty laundry to your customers and let them know that you're not secure in order for them to push back on the C-suite in order to spend some more money. I'm not sure that's really relevant here, especially for small and medium businesses. So I guess the question goes back to, well, does that mean that basically they have to have a cyber threat in order to really make a difference here? I think that might be a really interesting thing, but we do know that that does happen a lot in the market. We hear that all the time around organizations not really spending time on, you know, data compliance and other things because of the fact that it's too expensive to do so. Now, Chibert's actually in the back channel here because he can't stay away. And he says that, you know, obviously universities in general have a severe skill gap and researchers tend to push back on security challenges. So that's interesting. So that's, again, a bunch of finger pointing to say, hey, we don't have the experience over here. And we don't know how what to do to actually help here. And then, of course, then you have researchers on the other side to say, hey, like, you know, don't make any changes here because we have to continue our research. We have to make sure that there's not any roadblocks or impedance in the pipeline. And so we don't want you to make any changes here. I think I see this a lot, too. Now, Oliver, I'm going to throw this back to you. I see this a lot where organizations, they tend to slowly roll out updates, even on their Windows machines or on their workstations, because of the fact that it does create impedance on their business processes. So even that, at the very lowest level of just standard operating procedure here of putting updates, they slow it down only because it costs them money. So I guess the question back to you is, do we see an end in near? Like, is there a beginning to an end? Is there anything that we can do here?
I think there's, you know, iterative. I mean, I was being very negative. So I think there's iterative hope. Like for me, Microsoft just pitched me on Windows 365, right? Which I wrote up as being a great hybrid work solution. Of course, there's other, you know, desktop as a service platforms. But the good thing for even, say, my IT, my guys are going to hate me. But like if Davis IT department, you know, patching notebooks now, which are mostly sitting at home, is an extra headache that they don't need. If we use this, they don't care what you're running on, right? It's not their problem. And now Microsoft is taking care of everything on the back end. You can press a button from, you know, on Friday night if you're using Windows 10, and on Monday you're using Windows 11, and you didn't have to press a single button. That's the same for security updates. That's the same for security patches. Everything. I think if more stuff like that rolls out, that's very low friction and yet increases security. Yeah, that I think will help. Is there going to be more and nastier hiccups? Yeah. I mean, what is it? $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill just got passed over X number of years. And I don't know how much of that is going to go into internet bandwidth, but I bet quite a bit. And is there even going to be a serious effort to up security on our infrastructure, even at the hardware level? I hope there is. I personally don't have any guarantee of that, though. I mean, I think, frankly, the government's going to push it to whichever vendors they buy and hope that they take care of it.
Right. Yeah, Cheaper's even calling out here. Similarly, he says security hampers research. I mean, obviously, you have to play the perimeter game and make sure that you can do it at the perimeter rather than trying to make changes internally. I think it's true. I think that, you know, IT people are trying to get creative here because they don't want to spend the extra money. And so they're trying to make sure that they continue to maintain the perimeter security. But again, once the perimeter is breached, you're done. So I think this is a very interesting topic. I'm sure that over time, you know, hopefully it doesn't take massive breaches in order to, you know, again, businesses to kind of move the needle here. As crazy as it sounds, you'd think that the C-suite would want to, you know, ensure that they have the process in place because, of course, long-term impact here could be a lot of money loss. And I think that's the key here is once you have a breach, you lose your trust to your customers. And, you know, matter if they're industrial or enterprise customers or if they're, you know, consumers from, you know, standards consumers. And I think that's the key here is, you know, I think C-suite has to start thinking about those ramifications when it comes to spending dollars. But again, my guess is that the trend will continue mm-hmm. until things get more serious. So we'll definitely have to see what happens in the near future. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. Now we have the guest coming up, and that's my favorite part of the show. But before we get to my guest or our guest here, we do have to thank another great sponsor of this week in enterprise tech, and that's ThinkScary. The last thing anyone wants or needs right now is a data breach. We just talked about it. Rather than the villain lying in wait, you have a hero. That's Things Canary waiting for them. Now, companies usually find out too late that they've been compromised. Even after they've already spent millions on IT security, it just wasn't enough. Canary has completely changed the game. It's designed to be installed and configured in minutes and, pardon the pun, left to its own devices. You don't have to think about it. Attackers prowling a target network look for juicy content. They'll browse Active Directory for file servers and explore file shares looking for documents. They'll try default passwords against network devices and web services and will scan for open services across the entire network. Now, canaries can be deployed throughout the entire network, and you can make them look identical to a router, a switch, a NAS server, a Linux box, or a Windows server, so attackers won't know they've been caught. Now, Things Canaries are designed to look like the things hackers want to get to. You can put fake files on them or enroll them in Active Directory, and when attackers investigate further, they give themselves away and you're instantly notified. Now, you can also use Canary tokens. These are tiny tripwires that can drop into hundreds of places. They follow the Things Canary philosophy of trivial to deploy with a ridiculously high quality of signal. Now, if alert happens, Canary will notify you any way you want. Plus, you won't be inundated with false alarms. You can actually get alerts by email or text message right on your console, Slack, webhooks, syslog, or even their API. Choose the option that best works for your business. Now, it's important that companies know two things when it comes to data breaches. That's one, hackers usually take the path of least resistance, and that's typically your staff. We knew that. And two, it takes on average 191 days for a company to realize that there's been a data breach. That's too long, and Thinks Canary solves that problem for you. The people behind Canary has been in the security game for almost two decades and have trained companies, militaries, and governments on how to break into networks. And that's the knowledge they've used to build Canary. Now, Things Canaries are deployed all over the world on all seven continents and are one of the best tools against data breaches. Visit canary.tools/twit, and for $7,500 per year, you'll get five Canaries, your own hosted console, upgrades, support, and maintenance. And if you use code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box, you'll get 10% off the price for life. We know you'll love your Things Canary, but if you're not happy, you can always return the Canaries with their 2-month money back guarantee for a full refund. That's canary.tools/TWIT and enter the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box. And we thank Things Canary for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, that's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Ryan. Today we have Andy Bain. He's the CEO of Element. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Thank you, Lou. How are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks so much for being on the show. Now, our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. Can you take us through a journey through tech and what brought you to Element?
Yeah, happy to do that. I've, for decades, been in software, primarily serving asset-intensive industries, especially power generation, transmission, distribution, and helping them use their both IT, you know, their data-centric data and their operational data to solve hard problems. And so it's everything from control and automation all the way to work in asset management, field service management, and then, you know, a lot of what back in the day we used to call quants who are doing planning and forecasting. Today we call it data scientists, and they're doing, you know, AI and ML, but much the same problems, trying to figure out how do you optimize and make more efficient industrial operations, and how do you keep people safer and out of harm's way. And so that brought me to Element, where we had, you know, an opportunity to take this next level of the industrial Internet of Things and help industrial owner operators to take advantage of their IT/OT data to solve some of these hard problems.
Now, you brought me right into that first question here, because I think this is a really interesting part of the market that we haven't really covered too much of. And obviously, that's part of the supply chain here. Obviously, you talked a little bit about why Element was created. What kinds of the industry or what parts of the industry and products are you really trying to focus on here?
So we cut across a number of different sectors. So we're in chemicals, energy, food and ag, pharma. But we're most particularly focused on that plant floor, that power grid, that operational problem set that really is a lot of data coming off of equipment and off of processes, you know, the sensor data. And how do you bring that together in context so you can apply, you know, machine learning or even basic analytics? And so the problems our customers are trying to solve are, for example, predicting the failure of equipment and improving their uptime, things like that. That's pretty typical.
That's interesting because I've worked with a lot of organizations that have a lot of machines, they have a lot of manufacturing, and they are trying to find more ways to use predictive analytics to essentially figure out service catalogs and service timelines, whether they need to replace things ahead of time, stuff like that. Now, does your platform assist with this? Like, how does it assist?
So we're really focused on this problem of data contextualization so that you can actually do those analytics. One of the challenges in the industrial world is you've got a lot of time series data coming off of sensors, off of instrumentation that's on equipment. And that data is really nasty. It doesn't have an object model. It's all stored in a flat file, and it's very poorly labeled. And really, it only gives you a unit of measure and a timestamp. And so in order to predict the failure of a piece of equipment or to do something useful with the data, you have to bring in data from other sources like your SAP system or your engineering design system and try to create a richer context around that time series data. And we help solve that problem through software. Today, the way it's typically done is using spreadsheets, sometimes Python code, which really doesn't scale and it doesn't allow you to consume as much data as you would like to fulfill modern use cases. And so we get people off of spreadsheets and into software and use no-code, low-code pipelines and data transformations that are really built to go after this problem. And then we store all of that in a knowledge graph. So it's a very flexible way to build data models so that you can go after these use cases in more of a singular fashion, in more of a repeatable fashion.
Now, pardon the analog here that I want to put, but we talked a lot about Slack and how they work with cloud services and they ingest a lot of this data, both unstructured and structured, and they help similarly run it through some models and help you build out that pipeline to produce better analytics. It sounds like that's what you're doing for the industrial factor here.
Yeah, I think that's a good example. I'd say another one, perhaps you know, Thanksgiving's coming up and I'm always asked by my mother-in-law and others, hey, what do you do for a living? And I tell them I do data management software for industrial companies and try to, you know, avoid the discussion. But when they ask me more, well, tell me more about it. You know, what's the metaphor you use? And so I often say, well, do you use Google Maps or Waze for traffic navigation? And they'll say, oh, yeah, of course. And I say, well, really, that's a bunch of layers of data, roads and bridges and buildings. And all those layers of data have to be snapped together. And it's pretty easy to do in those applications because you have a geospatial key. What's the location on the earth? And then the raw data is what's the price of gasoline or what's the traffic pattern at a particular time when you're trying to go from point A to point B. Well, for industrial companies, they don't have an easy way. They don't have a geospatial key that allows them to snap together all their layers of data. So what we do at Element is we help them. We're the glue layer that brings together how is the equipment and the process designed? How has it been operated? You know, the time series data. And then how has it been maintained? When's the last time that pump failed or that compressor failed? What work is being done on that equipment? And so we help bring together all those layers of data so that you can get more of a Waze-like or Google Maps-like experience. We help them create a map of all their plants and then increasingly across their fleet of plants. We have customers who have 400 or 500 plants globally, and they want to do machine learning across like use cases. Well, it takes a lot of like data, and so we help them achieve that outcome.
Now, this sounds very similar to a lot of organizations trying to do a digital transformation. Obviously, they said that some of them are using spreadsheets and trying to build, you know, analytics off of that, which is challenging. That's using a digital process, but it's still very manual in approach, even if they're using macros. So what is the process an organization might follow? I'm a small manufacturing company that, let's say, is building shoes or something, and they want to jump in and actually start on your platform. What's the process they take to get there?
Well, so we deploy on both AWS and Azure, and they can go to the AWS or the Azure Marketplace, and they can even, you know, kick off with a free trial. But what they're able to do is connect their time series systems, whether it's like a data historian or some other time series system, and then there are other systems that bring context to that data, and often it's a lot of engineering designs. You know, how was the plant originally designed? Sometimes that's, think of it as CAD/CAM drawings. And we allow them to quickly bring that data together and get that digital representation of those physical assets and processes so that they can then run, you know, root cause analysis or predictive maintenance or whatever it may be. Typically, you know, the CEO has been at Davos and he's heard all about artificial intelligence and new analytics and seen these fancy screens, and they'll come back and say, hey, why aren't we doing this? And without realizing just how hard it is. And so companies will experiment and they'll get some good results, say on one use case. And then they go to try to scale it within a plant or across, you know, multiple plants, and they just stumble and they tend to fail because they can't solve this data contextualization and governance problem. And so that's typically where we come in to help them scale up and really get both the scope of use cases and then the scale of data at work in their operations.
So this is interesting. So you talked a little bit about the different parts of the industry. You talk about chemical and other places. Now, as you build and help with these different parts of kind of the industrial part of the market, do you feel like you're constantly expanding other markets just because this type of process or this type of pipeline can actually benefit a lot of different parts of the market, or is it you're still focusing on these traditional ones?
We're focused on the common thread is that they've got a lot of time series data that's mm-hmm. coming off of their control systems and off of their equipment. And, you know, you see similar patterns. These are highly self-referencing industries, and, you know, industrials are really account for 2/3 of the global economy right today. And so You can talk to, for example, a pharma company about a problem that a chemical company is solving, and that will make sense. But it's a little bit different if you're trying to say, hey, here's a use case where somebody's figuring out how to predict the failure of a piece of rotating equipment. You can't really talk to necessarily a power grid operator about that same sort of use case. So you do have to have some specialization around that industry subject matter expertise. But fundamentally, the problems are very similar, where it's bringing more context to that time series data, to that operations data, so that you can actually do something meaningful with it.
Fantastic. When we come back, we have more with Andy Bain, talk a lot more about data analytics. And I want to also bring Oliver back in here. But before we do, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And that's Melissa. Now, having accurate customer address data is crucial for the success of your business. Now, did you know that nearly 36 million address changes were processed by the USPS in 2020? That's a lot. That's a huge chunk of customers you could be missing out on. 30% of customer data goes bad each and every year, but Melissa can help make sure your data is current and accurate. Now, Melissa's tools have helped businesses maintain fresh data for over 35 years, which explains why over 10,000 businesses trust the address experts. Now, Melissa has a renewal rate of over 92%. And why is that? Well, because 25% is the typical return on investment realized by Melissa's customers. Now, you can verify addresses, emails, phone numbers, and names in real time with Melissa. And Melissa's global address verification service verifies addresses for 240 plus countries and territories at the point of entry. Now, tired of having duplicate customer information in your databases? Well, with Melissa's data matching, you can eliminate clutter and duplicates and increase accuracy of the database and reduce postage and mailing costs as well. Get the information that completes your customer profiles better. And you can actually add consumer demographic information to your records, such as marital status or social media handles. And Melissa's flexible deployment options offer different platforms to suit any preference, business size, or budget. Now, with flexible on-premise, web service, secure FTP processing, and software as service delivery options, Melissa also has their new Lookups app on iOS and Google to search addresses, names, and more at your fingertips. And Melissa continuously undergoes independent security audits to reinforce their commitment to data security, privacy, and compliance requirements. In fact, they're SOC 2, HIPAA, and GDPR compliant. And Melissa's Global Support Center also offers 24/7 world-renowned support if you sign up for a service-level agreement. Inquire today. Now, Melissa is still supporting communities and qualifying essential workers during COVID-19. See if your organization qualifies for 6 months of free service by applying online at melissa.com. In G2 Crowd's 2021 grid report, Melissa scored 89% for ease of use, 91% in quality of support, 96% in ease of doing business with, as well as 93% meets requirements. So you can see their commitment to providing the best data quality and address verification software around. Make sure your customer contact data is up to date. Try Melissa's APIs and the developer portal. It's easy to log on, sign up, and start playing in the API sandbox 24/7. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. And that's melissa.com/twit. And we thank Melissa for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Andy Bain. He's the CEO of Element. Now, I want to actually bring Oliver back in here because Oliver, he covers a ton of the IT world. And I want to get some questions from him, actually. Oliver?
Sure. First, what is data? I'm just kidding. So before Ziff Davis and the journalism stuff and before Microsoft, I did a bunch of software consulting for real estate property management companies. In Manhattan, guys with $10 billion portfolios. They have a lot of facilities, a lot of OT. So I know Lou kind of asked this, but would an outfit like yours be able to pivot enough? Is like, are the standards in IoT universal enough that Element could pivot to help companies like that? Or should companies like that be looking for specialists in their field? And if they should, where do they find them?
Oliver, that's a great question. The building spaces, and particularly for the kind of owners that you're talking about of many buildings and facilities, you see increasingly they're trying to do more at the edge and install edge devices in the facilities to do things like energy optimization and maintenance. And what they're trying to do is get this system of systems view where you get the HVAC system and the elevator, you know, and the fire suppression, and bring all those together so that you can better operate the building, whether you're trying to do maintenance or whether you're trying to, you know, reduce the energy consumption. And so we're absolutely working with some solution providers who are deploying those edge devices and then connecting them to the cloud to run AI to help those building operators become more energy efficient. So it's a very similar problem where you've got a lot of data sitting in disparate systems. You have to bring it together and then apply AI or some sort of analytics to help them optimize how, for example, they're consuming energy. Same's true in data centers and in other facilities where you can really leverage these technologies to operate more efficiently. So that's spot on.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Sure.
One of the wonderful things about those $10 billion guys is how amazingly clueless they are about not only what technology they have, what kind of data they have. You guys talk directly to those customers, right? Or is the middleware piece not like, would you not be talking exactly face to face with that customer, or would you? Quick question. Yes or no?
So we both sell to owner operators of, mm-hmm. of facilities and of, you know, chemicals and other sectors. But we also, some of our customers are the suppliers of those solutions that are optimizing energy in buildings or are even delivering software into the same sectors that we serve. And so the way we think about ourselves is sort of providing that neutral, independent software platform. So whether you're an end owner operator or you're an ISV or one of these digital OEMs that's trying to serve those end markets, we can help you solve that data management product. So you can get your time to value and time to cash accelerated as you're trying to deploy your own solutions, whether it's energy optimization or other use cases.
Okay. So given my ex-client's cluelessness, what is the one thing you wish those types of customers would do before you even walked in the door?
Understand how hard it is to get the work done. The world is still very much, you know, application into the data, and they just don't know what it means to be data centric and to understand that you're operating your facilities like an asset and it's on your balance sheet. Well, what if your data was on your balance sheet? And why don't you think of that as an asset? You were talking in bits and bytes about cybersecurity. If you had to carry the value of your data on your balance sheet, maybe some of those CIOs would be responding a little bit better to the cybersecurity challenge.
That's good advice. Thank you. I think I'll write something about that.
Yeah, there you go. Hey. It's interesting. Cheebert actually put a little anecdote in here as well. He obviously has some friends at Fluke, and they've actually created their own diode fab because they couldn't get diodes met their needs for accuracy. Now, the interesting thing is, the question is that story being repeated around the market? Because after you hear those types of bad stories about mainland fabs actually scrimping on quality, it seems to be a big hole for organizations, right? They have a big quality problem. Is this something that Element is trying to help plug here?
Yeah, we many of our customers, that's a top two or three use cases is around quality or overall equipment effectiveness. And are you getting the quality of the output based on, you know, machine availability and process, and or even how do we understand what's the golden batch or the highest quality batch, and we want to repeat that? Well, you need to understand from the data and from analyzing the data how you can repeat that level of quality, you know, continuously over time. And so we see that as always one of the top use cases that in particular industries like chemicals or pharma that they're absolutely going after.
Now, how many of these organizations don't really, Oliver got in this a little bit, but how many of these organizations don't really know that they have valuable data there? Like they just essentially think, you know, I have some data, I want to make some sense out of it, so I'm going to come to Element. But then you find additional, let us say, unstructured, unorganized data that can really bring value to their pipeline. There's a lot of organizations like that that just don't know the value of their data.
Yeah, it's really mixed. We tend to, you know, our hardcore users are, you could think of them as data engineers, but they're data engineers who typically have been trained in electrical or chemical or mechanical engineering, but they're younger and they know how to hack, and they definitely know the value of the data. As you sort of get generationally older, not all of them know the value of the data. It just sort of passes over across a screen in a control room, and that's it. And then it goes into cold storage to die. So there's a bit of a mix, but the younger engineers really understand not only the value of the data, but then how you can let the data reveal things to you that you otherwise, you know, wouldn't be looking for. And so they tend to be a little more open-minded and flexible in letting the data reveal, you know, answers to problems versus going in very prescriptively and, hey, I've been trained this way at university and here's exactly the way in my first principles, you know, physics models, I should be looking at the world, and I don't want to learn anything new. And statistics-based, you know, ML approaches just aren't meaningful in our environment. And so there is that divergence, and it tends to be a little generational.
Brings back memories that when I worked at Data Corp, we did some research on, a data fire hose from the, you know, from the field when they used to drive vehicles around, and, you know, measure the universal joints and then determine how to manufacture those better. And I think that, you know, a lot of these pipelines could have been really useful for that type of mechanism too, even just in product, capability. I want to get a little bit into the technology that you guys use here. Like, obviously this is you got a fire hose of data. You got to be able to scale your cloud service. What's some of the technology you're using here to be able to handle all this data?
So we deploy on, like I said, Azure and AWS. So for IaaS and PaaS, and we take advantage of elastic compute so that we can be, you know, as they say, infinitely scalable. But then, you know, we're using a number of different technologies, you know, open source and using a lot of Scala and other techniques. And then what, you know, makes what we're doing, I think, unique is we've got some graph technology that we built into the product that is, you know, in memory and does some things that weren't available before. That really gives us, I think, not only a competitive advantage, but most importantly, it helps our customers move faster and at greater scale as they work to build the relationships across the data, which is really the key to unlock it. You know, you've got a pump in a plant. Well, who manufactured the pump? All those sensors on the pump, is that sensor measuring pressures that on the inlet or the outlet side of the pump? When was the last time it was worked on? You got to build all those relationships. And that's what graph technology really allows you to do. And graph is finally at a place where it's affordable enough and good enough where you can really apply it to solve some of these problems. It's sort of the next level of primitive on top of MapReduce that unlocks a lot of potential.
Right. Now, since you're mentioning graph, you talked a little bit about the fact that organizations can use a little bit of no code, maybe low code solutions. Is there an API to expose this graph? How can the organizations integrate?
Yeah, so we've got, you know, typical API approach, and then we have a number of connectors where we can connect into source systems. And so, you know, for the harder code folks who want to, you know, for example, write Python into the system, we've got APIs for that. And then, you know, exposing the graph that's all sort of baked into this more data fabric-y like concept where you're doing the work in our product, but then you can push it to really any consuming system, whether it's in the cloud or on the edge. And so the beauty of what we're doing is we like to call it, you know, model once, consume anywhere. And so you can contextualize, model the data in Element Unify, and then you can ship that out to whether it's Snowflake or whether it's a data lake or even down on the edge in the legacy system to be able to consume the same data. So it's that sort of shop-worn term of a single source of the truth. You build that, and then you can take single slices of the truth to do whatever use case that you need to do.
Fantastic. Thank you, Andy. Thank you so much for being here. Unfortunately, all good things must come to an end. We're running a little bit low on time, but I did want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where you can learn more about, where their organization can learn more about and get started on Element.
Sure. So elementanalytics.com is our website. If you're routinely going to the AWS marketplace or the Azure marketplace to try new tools, new software, we're available on both of those marketplaces as well, and encourage you to get engaged, and we can help you on your IT/OT data transformation journey and help you solve some big problems. So thank you, Lou. Thank you, Oliver. Much appreciate your time today.
Thanks again, Andy. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. So definitely tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, Mr. Oliver Rist. Oliver, what's going on for you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you and all of your great work?
They can find me on PCMag.com, where we just released our identity management roundup, which was... That was a lot of complexity testing that stuff. We're about to kick off our voiceover IP roundup, which is annual and oh so much fun. Should be out there in January. But before that, totally unrelated to tech, it's Movember. So grow a mustache and go to us.movember.org and donate to prostate cancer because you might be saving your own butt.
Thank you, Oliver. Really appreciate it. Definitely do that. And I know a bunch of people on Twitter actually doing that as well. Well, I also have to thank everyone that makes the show possible, especially to you as well. You are the person who drops in each and every week to watch and listen to our show and get your enterprise and IT goodness. And I want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise news. Go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the guest information, the co-host information, of course, the links that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to the videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. That's right. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice, and listen on any one of your devices or on any one of your podcast applications. Of course, we're on all of them. And the best way to keep Twyatt going is to definitely support the show and subscribe. Plus, you may have heard, that's right, we also have Club Twit. That's right, it's a members-only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed that you can't it anywhere else. And it's only $7 a month. It's cheap. Now, one of my favorite things that come with this Club Twit is exclusive access to the members only Discord channel. There is some amazing characters in there and some great conversations. Awesome. Really great set of channels too. I like to peruse them and jump in and out of them and talk a bit with people about stuff. Really love that. So definitely join Club Twit and be part of that movement. Go to twit.tv/Club Twit to join today. Now, Club Twit also offers corporate group plans as well. It's a great way to give your team access to our ad-free tech podcast. Now, the plans start with 5 members at a discounted rate of $6 each per month, and you can add as many seats as you like. And this is really a great way for your IT department, developers, and tech teams to stay up to date with access to all of our podcasts. And just like those regular memberships, you can join the Twit Discord server and get those Twit Plus bonus feeds as well. So definitely join at twit.tv/Club Twit. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family members, and your coworkers with the gift of Twiet, because we talk about a lot of fun tech topics on this show, and I guarantee they will enjoy and think they're fun as well. So definitely share it with them and ask them to subscribe as well. Now, if you've already subscribed and you're available during the week, Fridays, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, we do this show live.twit.tv. Come check out the live stream. Come check out the live stream. We do the show live, and we can come to see all the behind the scenes. Come see how the pizza's made. Come see all the banter that we do during the show live on the stream. Plus, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into our live chat room as well. That's right. It's irc.twit.tv. We have some great reoccurring characters. Of course, we also have some new characters every week, and they ask some great topics. We have some great discussions in there. So definitely join the chat room and be part of the fun. Definitely, you can always hit me up on twitter.com/LouMM. There you can I post all my enterprise tidbits. Plus, I also have some great discussions with people like you. Plus, definitely DM me for show ideas. I'd love to hear about some show ideas. I've got some good ones in the last couple weeks from there. We've thrown on the calendar. So definitely hit me up there and throw some show ideas. You can always hit all of the co-hosts at twit.tv there. All the co-hosts will get the email, and we'll definitely check out your ideas or your questions along the way. So definitely check out that out and send an email to us. If you want to know what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft, definitely check out developers.microsoft.com/office. There we post the latest and greatest ways you can make your office solutions more productive for you. We talk a little bit about there the latest and greatest Office JavaScript API for Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and Outlook. And also check out all the latest and new ways to actually create macros. In fact, we have the new way called OfficeScript, which is Excel Online's way of creating new macros using TypeScript. So definitely check that out and be part of some of that new technology. I want to make everyone who makes this show possible, I want to thank them, and especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we couldn't do the show without them. So thank you for all their support over the years. And also thank you to all the engineers and staff at Twit. Of course, also thank you to Mr. Brian Chi. He's not only our normal co-host, but he's also our tireless producer. He's out having fun right now, but he also does all the bookings and plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you, Chibert, for all your support. I mean, before we sign out, we have to thank our editor for today. He makes us look good behind the scenes after the fact. Thank you, Mr. Victor B. Plus our TD for today. He's the talented Mr. Ant Pruitt, and he does a fabulous, amazing show called Hands-On Photography here on Twit. And I always want to hear what's going on that show. Ant, what's going on this week on Hands-On Photography?
Well, first, let me say thank you to Mr. Victor, because, brother, you make me look and sound good. And Lord knows I make my show challenging to edit. But this week I talked about just the photography workflow. You got yourself a gig, so what's the workflow to get it squared away and make sure that the client is happy and make sure that you don't pull all of your hair out? So, yeah, check it out, twit.tv/hop, and let's walk through a workflow of setting up a photography gig.
That sounds good. I definitely need a better workflow in my photography. I don't do gigs, but I just have... funnels and lots of fire hoses of photos. I need a better workflow to make them better.
Yeah, so I'll definitely got you covered on that too.
All right, excellent. Thanks, Ann. Appreciate it. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Do you have an iPhone, an Apple Watch, an iPad, or any number of Apple devices? Well, you have got to check out iOS today with me, Micah Sargent, and Rosemary Orchard. We cover all things iOS and help you get the most out of your devices.